The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is a show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you like this podcast, you might like Double Think. It's produced and co-presented by Aidan McKelvey, the producer of this program. And it's a long listen of an exploration of a philosophical idea. It's definitely worth checking out. Double Think, find it where you find your podcasts. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, rating. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so by email, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter as well. We're at @NewstalkScience. Coming up on this week's episode, everything you needed to know about fusion, the technology that, when it eventually gets here, will change everything as we know it. We'll be speaking to Ian Chapman, CEO of the UK Atomic Energy Authority. First, though, of course, it is time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype are Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story. I think it's always good to start with the bad news and end with the good, Shane. I know we cover climate change, and it seems like every week it's a different angle on bad news. And I don't know did you see that story only last week about record temperatures in Siberia? This is now the other part of the globe, extreme warming in the South Pole.
Yeah, this has been described by experts in Boulder, Colorado, as the ultimate canary in the coal mine, something that we just cannot ignore. It's a story about global warming happening, or climate change happening, at the South Pole, at the bottom of the world in Antarctica, where researchers in Wellington and in Ohio have been able to look at how temperature changes have gone there since the 1990s. When they've been looking at weather data and using climate models to look at the change in temperature there over the last 30 years. And unfortunately, what they're seeing is that the rate of warming there is three times greater than the average for the rest of the world. A little bit of good news in this is it may not be entirely our fault. So there are cycles in the climate, unfortunately, this cycle of warming is coinciding with the human-influenced warming effects. And you might think, okay, a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. It's just that when you add them together, you can reach tipping points in climate change.
Now, don't we hear of tipping points a lot, and haven't we heard of tipping points for quite some time? What makes this a tipping point?
Well, what makes it a tipping point here is that this is perhaps the most climatically remote place in the world. So its average temperature is minus 50 degrees at the South Pole. There's a US research station there who've been measuring this data. Interestingly, there's a Russian one not too far away, and they agree with them. So a little bit of political agreement there for once. But what's unusual is that it's so remote that you would not expect to see the effects of climate change at such a remote place. It's about 3 kilometers above sea level. So the South Pole is on a very high plateau. And so you don't normally get the weather effects in from other parts of the world. So what's happening here is there are changes in the South Pacific due to warming. And that is in turn pushing storms into parts of the South Atlantic that would not normally have such violent storms. And that is pushing warm air from the South Atlantic over the center of the Antarctic continent and is causing the warming effect to be three times greater than the average global warming. It really is concerning to think that there can be warming in such extreme places. You talk of tipping points. We have crossed so many of them already. We see ice sheets around the edges of the continent of Antarctica that are coming apart, that are the size of small European countries. And this is affecting the salinization of the ocean as well as ocean levels, as well also as the reflectivity effect that the ice gives, which is it's white, so it reflects a lot of the sunlight back out into the atmosphere. When it goes, it exposes darker water or rock below it, which absorbs heat and causes a cumulative effect. It's all very doom and gloom. But what I would say is that I listening to experts talking about climate change in the current more acute pandemic, they're saying that the amount of change needed for us to right the wrongs of climate change is far less than what we have been able to do for COVID-19. Now, I know the timescales are different, right? And that we all want to return back to a normal life after this pandemic. But there are probably things that we've all learned to do during the lockdown that we're not going to give up. And so habit change is slow, but we have all the capacity to change our mindsets when it comes to things. And so I'm hoping that from COVID-19, we can look at biodiversity and climate in a more positive way.
Okay.
Johnny, you're not convinced by that positivity.
Well, no, I'm not. I mean, I've said in this program before, although there is no alternative to having a bit of hope, I feel hopeless in the face of this. I really do. And I know hopelessness doesn't help when you're a science communicator trying to get people to change their lives and change their habits. But also, I mean, let's not lay the blame on the door of the consumer when the options are limited on the recycler, mm-hmm. when recycling doesn't make its way to where we think it's going to do. There are systems at play that are hugely problematic here, and the individual is publicly shouldering way too much of the blame compared to the people in power. I saw a video from George Monbiot the other day, and you know, he's someone who I really do respect, and I think more and more people are calling out these systems. But the resistance to change is so big. I just don't see this changing.
There's one thing I'd add, though, is that states have shown the capacity in COVID-19 to make changes along with individuals. Yeah. And you were right. Individual change, like we don't live as individuals. We live in societies, and societies have to change for us to change. I completely agree.
Yeah. Ruth, our second story is a much nicer story. And it's to do with birds and dialects, and it's quite surprising because of the speed at which we've witnessed a change.
Yeah, this is kind of viral change, or the equivalent of viral videos in the bird world. And so we're not talking about canaries anymore, but talking about white-throated sparrows, which are little birds that live in North America. And they have a very, very distinctive call, which birders have known for years. In fact, it's such a beloved little song that they've actually put words to it. So that the tune is put to the words of, "Oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada." And those last words are a little triplet that the bird sings, and I think we can listen to it now. So that's the original song that birders have known for years and years and years. But when this researcher was out walking about 20 years ago with a friend in British Columbia in Western Canada, the friend, a fellow bird watcher, remarked, "Your sparrows sound strange." And he realized when he listened that they did. So the birds had essentially substituted that little triplet for a doublet. So instead of Canada, 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 it was Canna, Canna, Canna. And I think we can listen to that variant now, and you can hear the doublet at the end. So what was remarkable, though, about what's changed is that now this new song has spread across the whole of Canada in the space of about 20 years. And scientists who study birds have always thought that birdsong didn't really change, you know, that things remain stable. There might be some unusual dialects, but they'd be very regional, and that song persisted in populations over decades and decades and decades. But Ken Otter, who led this research in the University of Northern British Columbia, was able to get access to citizen recordings of birdsong. So he got over 1,700 recordings of white-throated sparrows from all across Canada. And he was actually able to track over the last decade this song spreading, you know, all the way across the continent. And by 2017, it had reached all the way to the east, to Quebec. So it had traveled nearly 2,000 miles. And this is the first time.
Why, Ruth? Why would you change your song?
We don't know yet. I mean, initially they were wondering, was there some selective advantage? So it's young male birds that learn how to sing so they can attract a mate. And they wondered, you know, did this provide some sort of selective advantage to the birds that learned the new song? But they also couldn't understand how the song was spreading. So they actually attached little geolocating tracking devices to about 50 birds, and they thought that the birds would travel from where they normally live in Canada down to their migratory wintering grounds in California. But what they found was the birds from Western Canada actually flew to the central United States, where they seemed to meet up with birds from Eastern Canada. So these young male birds seem to be teaching each other the song in the migratory grounds and then taking it back home with them, where the females seem to prefer it. So it suddenly went viral.
Wow. Is that the first recorded instance of such a rapid change in birdsong?
It's the only recorded instance of such a rapid change. I mean, it's a real paradigm shift. Bird watchers have always thought that these songs were much more constant. I mean, you hear it all the time. Expert bird watchers can pick up a bird just by hearing a distinctive tune. So it's really, really interesting. And it's lovely because it was very much citizen science that helped them to pick this out. This was, you know, enthusiasts who'd recorded the song and uploaded them onto these databases where the researchers could go in and look at them. So as they said, it was like having 1,000 research assistants scattered across Canada to help them to do this work. And it's a lovely piece of science that was just published on Thursday.
Shane, new research shows that disaster movie fans are coping better with the pandemic. Tell me about this one. This sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, it's work from the University of Chicago, from psychologists there who worked with 310 volunteers, asking them about their movie preferences and also asking them about how they felt, how prepared they felt going into the pandemic, as well as information around their levels of anxiety, if they felt depressed, sleeplessness, etc. And they showed in this study that those people who watched a lot of apocalypse films, such as, like, you know, Contagion, the classic one about a pandemic, that these people were felt more prepared for COVID-19.
Everyone has picked this story up. I presume there's not a lot to it scientifically?
No, but however, like, my colleagues in the humanities would have known the basis for this sort of work for a long time. So we watch TV shows, we read books, we do these things because it allows us to imagine a different way. So you can empathize with, particularly a good story will bring you in and you can start to imagine what it might be like to live that life. So the Stoics in philosophy will have talked about this for a long time. And people can actually get to the point of going and running that scenario in their own heads to think, well, what would I do if this happened? It doesn't always have to be a disaster. It can be good stuff as well as bad. Most of it's around relationships. And so this is putting a little bit of a sort of a psychological spin on it. I think more interestingly, it brings up for me the broader sense of, like, science isn't the only way of knowing things. And I think we've all got a sense from the humanities and from just living our lives that we've known this sort of thing for a long time anyway. You didn't need to measure it.
You're kind of like Captain Planet, Shane. You always have a little moral at the end of the story. There's always something we can learn from it, from, you know, and grow. Our final story has to do with dogs, Ruth.
Yes. So, of course, we've all learned for years that if you want to know how old your dog is, you multiply their age by 7, and that gives you their age in human years. But researchers this week from California San Diego School of Medicine have published a paper which shows that is completely wrong. So they were interested in looking at aging in humans, and they've studied that for years. And the way that they look at aging is they look at a process called methylation, which is where chemicals are attached onto our genes, onto the DNA, to switch genes off as we get older. And usually there's genes that are switched off or related to development. So, you know, through different stages of development, you need to turn genes on and off. So this is the body's way of managing aging. But instead of looking at humans this time, they decided to look at dogs. So they studied over 100 Labradors, and they looked at the areas of the genome where we know we've good information about how humans age. And they looked at these in puppies all the way through to much older dogs. And they found very, very similar patterns of these changes in the DNA in dogs. But what they found was the change didn't happen at the same speed as in humans. And they found that dogs aged much, much more rapidly, particularly when they were young. And again, I actually think for people who are dog owners, this research probably won't come as that much of a surprise. So when they correlated what they found in dogs to what we know about humans, they estimated that a 1-year-old dog has a human age of about 30. And then by four, a dog would be 50.
Don't we all grow older quicker? I mean, isn't this the same in humans?
No. So of course, we do. I mean, humans change far more in the first year of life than they do in the second, you know, and of course, it does slow down. So we've all got very good at looking at graphs of curves because of the pandemic and aging. Obviously, you do get that exponential rise where you get a very steep curve initially and then it levels off. And of course, that is true in humans, but it's much more extreme in dogs. So and it's not that surprising. I mean, a dog can have puppies by the time it's 9 months old. So, you know, it's not that surprising. You know, it's not like a seven-year-old. It's not like a human seven-year-old at one. And again, I don't think dog owners would be that surprised at this data. But it does level off. It does seem to slow down more dramatically than in humans. So by the time a dog is nine, they equate that to a human in their mid-60s. And by the time a dog is 14, it's like a human in their mid-70s. So again, that correlates quite well with the longevity that we expect in the two different species.
Right, so there's like a very steep hump at that first few years, and then it tailors off quite quickly. So the seven is an average?
I guess it is an average. I mean, if you take a dog that lives for 11 years and a human for 77, but that's really where that number came from. It was just a crude dividing one by the other. But if we're trying to actually look at aging, and of course, the reason why the researchers are looking at this work is because we're trying to understand aging. And we're particularly trying to understand, are there any interventions which could actually slow down the aging process in a healthy and meaningful way? So that's why it's useful to have other species to compare humans to. And often this whole area of comparing genomes or comparing our DNA is a very useful way to get insights into what's happening in one or both species. So it's a nice piece of work kicked off by some dog lovers. And again, it's got such wide coverage because I think people really identify with their dogs and they want to understand them more. So it's a paradigm turned on its head in the animal world for a second time on News Round today.
Well, Shane has got a big grin on his face. He's a big dog lover, so he must have loved that story. Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Now, humankind has long gazed up into the sky, marveled at the sun, and dreamt to wield its colossal power. But we've actually known how to do this for quite some time. But it's only now that we might be in a position to act and harness the incredible potential of nuclear fusion, thus embarking on an age of clean, sustainable, and safe energy production. Sounds too good to be true? Well, let's find out. Let's speak to Ian Chapman. He's Chief Executive Officer at the UK Atomic Energy Authority. Welcome to the programme, Ian. Would you mind starting off with the very basic distinction of the difference between fission, which we use at the moment in nuclear reactors around the world, and fusion?
Yeah, so both fission and fusion are nuclear processes, but they use elements at the opposite end of the periodic table. So in fission, you take really heavy stuff, uranium and plutonium, and you break it apart, and that releases energy. As you split it apart, it releases energy. And you can use that energy to create electricity. Fusion's the other end, where we take really light things, hydrogen and helium, and squeeze them together, fuse them together, and that also releases energy. Now, fission, as you say, we've known how to produce electricity for 60 years using fission. Fusion has enormous potential, but it's really hard to do here on Earth.
Why is it so hard?
The reason that it's so hard, I mean, fusion works, right? All of the stars and the sun is fusing in its core, and that's where the energy of the sun comes from. So we know it's possible, but the sun has gravity. So when to get fusion energy, you have to pull isotopes of hydrogen really, really close together to get them close enough that they overcome their natural repulsion. So if you remember sort of O-level physics, you try and put two magnets close to one another, and they push apart from each other. And the same is true with hydrogen. You know, they're positively charged and they want to push apart. So you have to get them really, really close to get them to fuse in the first place. Now, in the sun, that happens because of gravity. There's so much mass that it's pulling and squeezing the hydrogen really close together to make it fuse. We obviously cannot recreate the mass of the sun here on Earth, right? So instead, we need to give a lot of energy to that hydrogen to make it really, really hot, so that it's moving a sufficient speed that it can overcome the natural repulsion and get close enough to fuse. And when I say a lot of energy, what I mean is that the fuel inside a fusion reactor has to be about 10 times hotter than the center of the sun. about 150 million degrees, right? You just can't imagine that sort of temperature. It's just stupidly hot. But yeah, we do it every day.
So I'm trying to think of a good analogy for where the energy comes out of fusion. But I suppose if you're squeezing those two atoms together, there's sort of a pop in which the two atoms sort of become one, right? Become two lighter elements become a heavier element. And in that moment, energy is given out.
Exactly. So this comes down to, you must have heard Einstein's formula, E equals MC squared. And both fission and fusion rely on that formula. And in both cases, you have a difference in mass. So the two things that go in are heavier than the thing that comes out. And so that the difference in mass comes out as energy, it's spare energy, which is no longer needed to bind together the new product, the helium that comes out of the reaction. And so you get this sort of excess energy, which you can use ultimately to, you know, power light bulbs and things.
So I get some of the ideas, but if we're talking about 10 times the center of the sun at 15 million degrees, 150 million degrees Celsius, surely even steel vaporizes at that temperature. Like what could we possibly do to create something that hot?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a big challenge for fusion, is how you cope with that sort of enormous heat. And the way that we cope with that is by not letting it touch anything. So we have a ball of gas that we sort of levitate and hold away from the walls of the machine that we put it inside. So if you let it touch the box, you're right, it'll just vaporize, it'll melt the walls. So we have to levitate it, hold it away from the wall. And we do that using very big magnets. So it's all charged, and those charged particles will respond to a magnetic field. So we effectively have a sort of magnetic cage that we hold the fuel away from anything to make sure it doesn't touch it. Because you're entirely right, something at that temperature definitely will melt.
So you've got these atoms suspended because of their charge. So presumably not a lot of this stuff. You're talking about hydrogen and helium. When you're trying to push them together, how many atoms actually get pushed together in each experiment?
Well, lots. There's lots of them, but you're entirely right that in terms of actual mass, it's just a few grams. So I use this analogy that for the rest of my life, the next 60 years, all the electricity I need from fusion could come from the water in a bathtub and the lithium in two laptop batteries. And, you know, I could go and run a bath now and I own two laptops. So all the fuel I need, I have. So it's really, really high energy density. And from that water and from that lithium, we can extract two types of hydrogen, one fuel called deuterium, which is just heavy hydrogen, and tritium, which is very heavy hydrogen, and fuse them together. So it's just actually just a few grams of fuel would keep me going for the rest of my life.
Now, deuterium is easy to get, right? It's everywhere, as you say, it's in water. Tritium is slightly harder to process and manufacture so that you can push these two things together to create that reaction.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So deuterium, we just extract from seawater. Tritium is short half-life radioactive. It has a half-life of about 12 years. So you don't find it naturally because it just decays away. So you have to make it. Now, fortunately, it's reasonably possible to make it. So the fusion reaction itself produces a very energetic neutral particle, a neutron. And as that neutron passes through the wall, you can put in the wall some lithium. And there's lots of lithium. That's what you find in batteries. So you put some lithium in the wall. As the neutron goes through the lithium, it produces tritium. And then we can extract the tritium and feed it, you know, keep putting fuel on the fire, feed it into the reactor to keep the reaction going.
You can see why it's such a tantalizing prize. It is the elixir of youth in a way, the font of endless energy. The problem I have with this idea, and I'm sure this is one of the biggest challenges, is you're creating these enormous temperatures with a tiny bit of material. How do you get to a stage where you put in less energy than you get out?
Yeah, so you're entirely right, that we know fusion works, and we know that we can do it here on Earth. In Oxfordshire, which is where I am now, we operate the biggest fusion facility in the world, a machine called JET. And we've demonstrated that we can get fusion power out of jet. We still hold the world record. It's about 16 megawatts we produce, which is like a few wind turbines. But to get the fuel really hot and fusing in the first place, we had to put 25 megawatts in to get the fuel up to these enormous temperatures. So, you know, companies don't pay us to do that. So fusion is possible, but at the moment we've had to put more energy in than we extract. So we absolutely need to demonstrate that we get a lot more power out than we put in to get the fuel hot in the first place. But we know how to do that. We're pretty confident we know how to do that. And about 15 years ago now, most of the westernized countries in the world, so the biggest scientific collaboration that's ever happened, that humankind has ever embarked on, we started a project called ITER, which is designed to produce a lot more power out than we put in. So we put 50 megawatts into ITER, and it will produce 500 megawatts out. And that's like the power consumption of Dublin, right? That sort of level. So it'll prove that fusion is not just possible, but possible on a commercial scale that could produce large scale fusion here on Earth. And ITER has been a long time in the making, but it's now 70% built. It's being built in the south of France, and it will turn on in 2025. So it's such an exciting time to be in our community, in our field, because we're going from fusion is possible to fusion is actually happening, and we're doing it, and we're producing a lot more energy out than we put in to get the reaction going, and we're demonstrating that it is possible on scale. And it'll just be a sea change for our field when that happens.
I've been fortunate enough to visit both Jet and Cullum, where you work, and also I've actually stood in the place which will reach that 150 million Celsius. I was lucky enough to actually stand where it will be. Am I right in saying it will at one stage be the hottest place in the galaxy?
Certainly in our solar system. So much hotter than our sun. I don't know about the entire universe, but certainly in our solar system.
Right. But how do you get the energy out of that? How do you direct it towards presumably batteries in the future, or the power station?
Yeah. So 4/5 of the energy that is produced in the fusion itself, 4/5 of that is embodied in neutrons. These are neutral particles. So they don't feel the magnets. So they just stream out in all directions. And because they're streaming out in all directions, they don't put too much heat or power into any one component. And it's those neutrons which ultimately you use to produce electricity, a bit like a fission station. So a fission station produces neutrons as well. The neutrons are captured in the wall. That wall gets hot, hot enough to turn water into steam, and then steam turns turbines and it produces electricity, much like a coal station or a gas station.
Wow.
Conventional power after that. It's just a really fancy kettle in the middle to produce.
I had imagined something, because, you know, this idea of fusion is such a, inverted commas, super futuristic idea. I'd imagined it was more complex than that, but it's the same idea of creating steam. Wow. So what about the engineering that's required then? Because you're working on a system that's trying to do this in a smaller space, but take me through the engineering and the physics of the outside of this this machine, where you can, you know, where you can walk and so on through the various levels till you get to the center, because there's some really bizarre engineering and facts about how temperatures and how materials change as they get to the center, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I just talked about 4/5 of the energy going with the neutrons, but we didn't talk about the other 1/5, right? So the 1/5 of the energy is in charged material. So it's produced in helium. So helium comes out as charged. And so that is captured by the magnets. But just like any gas or liquid, there is turbulence in it. So in the same way that, you know, air going over an aeroplane wing, there's some turbulence, or water going through a pipe, there's some turbulence. Inside this ball of gas, which is hotter than the sun, but about 100 times thinner than air, lo and behold, there's a bit of turbulence. So this hot stuff, this helium that's really, really hot in the middle of the fusion reactor, which is the byproduct, some of that will get out to the edge. And when it gets out to the edge, you have to make sure it doesn't just go out and hit the wall, because that would melt some of the wall. So what we do is use more magnets, different magnets, which then sweep any of the lost power, the helium which escapes because of turbulence, we sweep it down to a sacrificial surface at the bottom of the device. And that surface does melt. It does erode over time. And every few years, you'd have to stop operation, go in and replace that sort of sacrificial surface because it's melted away, and then start operating again. And that is, frankly, one of the big challenges in fusion, in that the heat which is incident on that sacrificial surface is like re-entrant space shuttle or an arc welder, you know, things that are designed to melt.
Yeah.
And we're putting that sort of level of heat into what is ultimately a nuclear device. And so, you know, making sure that you don't melt the wall is primarily important to us. And that is one of the big challenges that fusion faces. Now, the design for ITER is essentially set at the known melt temperature of the material. So we've made ITER the size it is so that we don't melt the wall. But that makes it for quite a big machine. So ITER, to give you some sense of scale, ITER is about the size of Wembley. So it's like 120 meters, 80 meters across, 80 meters up in the air. So it's really quite a big plant. You want to be able to build smaller machines that are much cheaper. And so whilst that's possible, and conceptually, that's a great idea, and we have a brilliant compact machine like that here in the UK, but you have to make sure that you don't melt the wall. And that's the sort of the big challenge. If we can find a really clever way of exhausting the heat, we can build smaller, cheaper plants. And that's something that we are testing.
Is the heat very concentrated? I remember, I think I was doing a tour and they were saying that, you know, just a foot away or 2 feet away from this extremely hot center where the reaction happens, you're actually at room temperature. Is that right? Like the distance between intense, crazy 150 million degrees Celsius and, you know, being able to wear a t-shirt is only a couple of feet.
Yeah, entirely. The thermal gradients that we have to deal with are pretty enormous. So as you said, the fuel in the middle, 150 million degrees. The wall, this sort of sacrificial bit where the heat comes out, which is only 2 meters away, has to be a few hundred degrees, or it would melt, maybe up to 1,000. And then another meter behind that, you have some magnetic coils, which are cryogenically cooled. And so they're almost at absolute zero. So you've gone from 10 times hotter than the sun to the coldest place in the universe in the space of 2.5 meters.
So the engineering behind this is pretty incredible. And of course, the advancement of science to understand our world has, you know, has legitimacy in my and many other people's eyes anyway. But when ITER is up and running, because the output is, you know, did you say double or 10 times?
10 times.
10, yeah, so 10 times the output from the input, and the input is just water and lithium, or the waste products are water and lithium. Does that mean that once that's working, we can just rubber stamp ITERs around the world and solve the problem, or is ITER way off what it needs to be?
Yes, yeah, so ITER won't run steady state, and ITER won't be cost competitive. And ultimately, for fusion to get into the market, the consumer, you and I, have to want to buy the fusion electricity that's produced. And if it happens to cost twice as much as electricity produced from gas, are we really going to buy it? So it has to be cost competitive. But the first of a kind, ITER is not designed to be cost competitive. It's not designed to produce cost competitive electricity. And it won't, right? But it's first of a kind. It's a demonstrator. Then you need to learn how you drive the price down. How do you drive down the cost so that the consumer wants to buy it? And this is the journey that photovoltaics have been on, fission before that, offshore wind now. You know, the prices have come down and down and down such that they can compete with the market, but only through years of technical advances and subsidy from government and investment from the private sector. And fusion will have to go on that path where we'll have to bring the price down so that it competes in the market. So fusion needs all of those things. In terms of public acceptability and the comparison with fission, so why do people have problems with conventional nuclear power? There's sort of two reasons. One is the risk of chain reaction, and so meltdowns and nuclear accidents, which we saw at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, and risk of it at Fukushima. That is physically impossible in fusion. If you want to stop fusion happening, you can stop it in a millisecond. You know, so it's so easy to stop the risk. It's really hard to keep it going, but it's so easy to stop it. And the problem with conventional nuclear is the very long-lived legacy waste, which will last for hundreds of thousands of years. Again, fusion produces some waste in that we produce some neutrons, and so the steel will become mildly radioactive, but it's not on the same timescale. So it's much shorter radioactive waste at the end of it, consistent sort of with a coal plant or other conventional plants.
So what is the jump then from ITER to a commercial plant that makes money and is a viable template for the rest of the world to change how we use energy forever?
Yeah, there are lots of different approaches to that. Different countries are taking different approaches. I'll tell you what we're doing in the UK. We're taking the approach that but ITER is big. As I said, it's the size of Wembley. And so it costs quite a lot. It's sort of £20 billion to build ITER. And if every time you're building a unit, you have to raise, even if it's 15 billion for the next one, it's still a lot of money. And so the cost of capital is high. And really only governments can do that. And so the penetration rate into the market at that sort of ticket price is going to be quite slow. So we've taken the approach of trying to drive down the scale and the cost. And we have a concept in the UK for a much more compact fusion reactor, much smaller. We built the first one in the world, and it worked beautifully, far more efficient. You use a slightly different geometry, which makes much more efficient use of your magnets. And your magnets are really what cost you a lot of money. It's about a third of the price of ITER is the magnets and the cryostat to hold the magnets.
Whoa.
And a third is the buildings to put these big magnets in. So if you can make your magnets cheaper and put them in smaller buildings, then you can strip out billions of cost. So we came out with an idea to do that. We still have the best one of that design in the world. And the rest of the world, if I'm honest, have looked at us and said, that's a really nice idea, but you still need the fuel to be hotter than the sun. And so if you put something that's hotter than the sun into a much smaller box, the chances of melting the box are obviously much higher. So you need an even better way of exhausting the heat. And we held our hands up in the sort of mid-2000s and said, you're right, if we don't come up with a better way of exhausting the heat, this is a dead end, it's not going to work. But we now think we have a better way of exhausting the heat. We've spent the last 6 years building a machine to test exactly that. And we think we're going to be able to take the heat flux level from, we were talking before about re-entrant space shuttle level or arc welder level, down to a heat flux which is sort of in your car engine. And, you know, we've known how to build car engines for a long time. So if we can do that, it is an absolute game changer for fusion, that you can now build much more compact plants. And on the back of that invention, the UK government invested 200 million last year into a concept design program where we're going to design a fusion reactor for this really compact, small, lower cost option.
You know what I'm going to finish off asking you, Ian, don't you? How long away do you think is fusion?
The how long away is fusion really depends on how much risk and how much money you want to put into it. The way I always answer this question is a much cleverer man than me, a chap called Lev Artsimovich, who was one of the inventors of fusion reactors, was asked exactly this question back in the 70s at a press conference. And he said, fusion will be ready when humankind needs fusion. And I think that is true today as it was then. And as the climate change emergency is gripping more and more and people realize that we have to decarbonize our economy, we need other solutions. And fusion is a great one, a great solution that should be part of the portfolio. So I hope that there will be more investment, more companies, more industry working in this space, which will drive progress.
Ian Chapman, Chief Executive Officer at the UK Atomic Energy Authority. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So I've been to this facility, as I said, some people say ITER or ITER, and it's this sort of huge sprawling complex in the south of France. And the amount of engineering that goes into building, as I'm sure you're aware, is huge. But like, I spoke to some of the scientists there and I said, like, what is it like working on this? And they were really grasped the idea that they were working on the holy grail of energy and they were working on the solution to all of our problems in many respects. It was pretty cool. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through texts and tweets. We should go there, Aidan. We should head out to ITER and and have a wander around. Because when I went there, it was literally just sort of a building site. It'd be great to be there when they start turning shit on and blasting stuff, which is not what they do, but you know.
How long ago was that you were there?
I was there 2 years ago with 10 Things to Know About, and we talked about fusion and the promise of all that. I'd say it's very close to being ready now. It certainly wasn't anywhere near that. That center of the experiment that I was talking about was essentially a concrete room, an empty concrete room. And the place I was standing, I was told, was going to be the hottest place in the universe. Because you just do not get heat naturally at this sort of level, which was so cool.
That is incredible. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So we should see if we can go there, you know, when they're turning on, because I'd say it would be very impressive. And I know they'll probably be looking for, you know, professional science journalists like ourselves, Aidan, you know?
Absolutely.
So our emails and texts from last week, we were talking about false noble widows or noble false widows. We had Claire on. She says, expected better than scaremongering about a spider that's been in Ireland for 30 years. You would have to be tremendously unlucky to A, get bitten, and B, have a bad reaction to a false widow. And I was like, yeah, but we were just having a bit of fun. Like, is it okay to have a bit of fun over spiders? And I think, Dr. Lara Dungan, who was doing the piece, she's genuinely afraid of spiders. Like, she's a smart woman. She's a very smart woman. But spiders give her the creeps. I think that's okay, isn't it, Aidan?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't there, so I when I'm not there, I usually blame all of the controversies on my not being there. But then when I actually read the text, I was like, this doesn't seem very controversial.
Yeah.
It seems like you were just talking about a spider, the fact that it's venomous.
Yeah, well, she followed up in fairness, and she said, I love Future Proof, just don't need more reasons for people to squish spiders during a mass extinction. The risk from false widows is still as low today as it was yesterday. Look, absolutely. And I think we have really matured as a culture, certainly when it comes to spiders. I mean, I remember being out recently and there was a kid, and even just a I think a 10-year-old was telling a 4-year-old, don't kill the spider. The 4-year-old wanted to stomp on it, and he hadn't yet been indoctrinated into the spider loving culture that exists. Like, it seems like everybody wants to protect spiders. Like, killing spiders now like throwing litter, it seems to me. So I think I think socially we're in a good space.
Definitely, and it's the same with a couple of insects as well. Like, when you're a kid, insects are icky, and we all know kids who are like cutting up worms for no good reason and taking the legs off begging daddy long legs. But now it's like the bees are like the most, like, one of the most beloved animals in our community. Everyone's like, yeah, save the bees, and it's great.
Yeah, well, we'd be after without the bees, wouldn't we? Phil in Wexford says, I was bitten by a false widow and ended up in hospital for 4 days. We've loads around the house and shed. So, see, horses for courses in some respects. But look, absolutely do not squish your spiders. Alan Goodison said, also in the press release of that study says, although our study shows that the venom of false widow spiders may be even more potent than we thought, it doesn't mean we need to fear them. In many parts of the world, even true black widow bites rarely require medical attention. It's funny, isn't it? Sometimes just a name can alter your perception of something. Like, the black widow sounds so dangerous. I assumed it was a fatal spider bite every time, but obviously as I grew up I learned that that's not the case, but actually rarely requiring medical attention. I didn't know that. We were talking about broken hearts as well last week, and how the breakups that we have, the huge emotional losses that we can sometimes experience through breakups or through a loved one dying, actually can disease the heart. And in a physical way, it's not something I'd ever thought about. But we asked you about broken hearts and whether or not you had any stories. Ramiro and Brida, some 60 years together. Rami, after a long time ill, died. Brida was strong and healthy at his funeral, but 4 days later she joined him. Well, rest in peace, both Ramiro and Brida. I'm not surprised in some ways, because there are so many stories of this. Hi, Jonathan. I just caught the end of your interview with Sandeep Jahar. His subject is fascinating. My father died in 1983. He had heart disease, and the cause of death on the certificate was endocarditis. He died within a few weeks of my brother Paul being involved in a car accident. Paul was in a coma when my father died. My mother always claimed that my father died of a broken heart. That's from Mary Walsh. Amazing story, Mary. And I'm sure everyone has one story of one loved one following straight after the death of their beloved, which is romantic in a way, but also very difficult for families. Do you have any of those stories, Aidan?
I do, actually, yeah. Our neighbour had they were this couple, and they were about my parents' age, and this must be 10, 15 years ago now, and they were this, like, the most kind of coolest couple, really alive, really, like, healthy. And they went away on a holiday, and the father had a heart attack. And when the mother came back, understandably, she was never the same. And I don't think she survived a year. She died a few months later. Like, and you know, there was, up until that point, I don't, as far as I'm aware, there was no health issues really at all. So we always put it down to that. But you know, they're anecdotal, so you never really know. But it certainly seemed that way with her.
Yeah, it is romantic, isn't it? In a Edgar Allan Poe sort of way. We also had a great chat with a scientist who worked on explosions called Jackie Ackerman. And she was telling us about her work in which she tried to figure out the mechanics of explosions. And she ended up doing work for defense forces and so on, and we asked her about that, but she was telling us about how different explosions work. Some need fire and some don't, and she was talking about TNT, which we all sort of associate as being a very explosive material. And Fabian in Sanimet says there's more energy in sugar than in TNT per unit weight, but it doesn't release energy as quickly, so it's not as explosive. That sounds like such a brilliant fact, Fabian. I know that my producer, Aidan McKelvey, will have fact-checked it, so I don't sound like an idiot reading it out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I haven't done that. I was off last week, remember? You can't check all of the tweets.
That's literally your job. And then Mairead Fitz on Twitter was tweeting and saying, "Hey, McRae, did you hear Shane Bergen cheat on you with another radio station yesterday? You're way more crack on Future Proof, sure. Didn't I nearly fall asleep?" Now, in fairness to Shane, it was about falling asleep, so it was a bit of a joke. Okay, I think that's it. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, who is researching, and on sound, Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.